This went wrong right from the very start, because there was a misunderstanding between Adam and I about sort of me doing something this evening. So I wasn't aware that that I would been programmed to do anything today until Adam sent me an email this morning. And as I've had to be out all day, I haven't actually been able to prepare anything. So the only thing I can suggest, what I've suggested to Adam, is that I can waffle on for, sort of off the top of my head for a bit, and then sort of we can go into conversation. But my mind is not very linear, so it's probably likely to dodge all over the place. So I don't know what you're going to get. But if that's okay with everyone, then I can give that a go. Dead silence.
Yeah, I'll take that. Fine,
take that as a yes.
It'll be fine.
Okay, by me.
Okay. All right then. Well, I can't promise that. I can't remember what I've spoken about this subject of hunter gatherers quite a lot. So I don't know what you have heard me say and what you haven't, or what you've gleaned from elsewhere. This was something that I got really interested in about 10 years ago. I found it a fascinating subject. And especially with the discovery of egalitarianism, what anthropologists generally describe as egalitarianism among hunter-gatherers. But you have to be a bit careful about their definitions. Anthropologists are notorious for not having any kind of fixed technical vocabulary, so what they say can mean a lot. Different anthropologists mean different things by these terms. And historically, the term egalitarianism was applied to any group which had male egalitarianism. And there are many of those. Many tribal groups, many types of hunter-gatherers have male egalitarianism. That's egalitarianism between men, but women are generally subservient to various degrees within these societies. And it's only very recently that the term has been applied more strictly to societies which are fully egalitarian to the extent that they include gender egalitarianism within them. And that is now generally the meaning of the term as it's applied by anthropologists who are specifically focused on hunter-gatherers, but you will still find the old term used among other anthropologists. So if you come across it, do just be a little bit careful. Okay. With the existence of egalitarianism among a specific type of hunter-gatherer, there are various types of hunter-gatherers. Some of which are not egalitarian at all, some are partly egalitarian, and some are fully egalitarian, as we would understand. Well, fully, there are always very slight degrees of inequality, but, they are so slight that they're really not worth sort of thinking about. So with this, I mean, this is obviously of interest to us. So the question is, how did they maintain their egalitarianism, and is it reproducible under conditions of large-scale production? This is the question that is always kind of buzzing around in the back of my head, and it's the question that is still quite sort of open for an answer. But the very fact of human egalitarianism is itself a little bit of a conundrum. Because if we look at our nearest kind of relatives, evolutionary relatives, the great apes, the chimpanzees and the gorillas, and even the orangutans, and more widely among primates generally, what you find is the very opposite of egalitarian relationships. And especially among our closest relatives, chimpanzees and gorillas, you find extreme hierarchical relationships, quite extreme, right? Even in terms of the general sort of run of sort of the types of societies you find in primate societies, and also in just mammalian societies generally. Our nearest relatives are highly non-egalitarian. They have quite violent hierarchical societies. And in those societies, violence and fighting are the source of the hierarchy. That's the way that the hierarchy is maintained. So you have alpha males, generally speaking, at the top. Certainly in primate societies, alpha males. Some other mammalian species, it can be alpha female. The dogs, for example, are a matriarchal society. It's the females that run the show. And even among matriarchal and our sort of bonobo kind of relatives who are very close to us, which are matriarchal, there is and generally speaking, not so violent as the other species. They still maintain an element of hierarchy, and that hierarchy can be maintained in terms of violence as well. So I mean, it's been kind of well documented that pissed off female bonobos, quite sort of happy to attack males and bite their penis off, and seems to be one of their kind of ways they keep control of the males. So where do we fit into all this? How come historically we appear to have developed egalitarian relationships? And it really is a bit of a conundrum. We just don't know. I mean, we seem to, evolutionary development seems to have been U-shaped. We started off, I mean, because we are closely related to other primate species, we have to infer, we can't say with 100 degrees certainty, but we have to infer that like them, like all of our relatives, we were once, at least in our pre-Homo sap existence, hierarchical creatures. So how we got from that to historically egalitarian relationships is it really is something of a mystery. There are lots of theories, of course, about it, each of which has a certain amount of evidence in support of it, but there is nothing that we can say for certain how that actually happened. But we know that it did happen. We can, again, we can't be 100% certain, but we have enough evidence to be to develop quite a strong conviction that historically, right throughout, at least for hundreds, 100, 200,000 years of our historical existence, we lived in egalitarian societies. Well, how do we know that? Well, first of all, that is that all known existing band societies are in fact egalitarian. There are absolutely no exceptions to this. Every single one of them that we've ever encountered, and we found them on all continents and on many islands, both sort of as living re social realities and as historical realities, we have found them, and they have invariably been, as band societies, they have been invariably egalitarian. By band societies, what I mean is societies that move from place to place, they forage and they hunt. So any societies which are mobile always are egalitarian in our historical past. Not all existing hunter-gatherers are mobile band societies. There are some which are village societies, and most village societies, although they are not necessarily fully egalitarian, all maintain high levels of egalitarianism in their relationships. The only hunter-gatherers that we existing hunter-gatherers that we know of that are not egalitarian are definitely not egalitarian. They are stratified societies. Stratified is kind of what an anthropologist would call them. We would call them class societies. Many of them, for example, have slaves, and there is certainly hierarchical relationships between higher and lower sort of groups within those societies. But the all of the mobile societies we know, hunter-gatherer societies, are egalitarian. There are a number of theories. Some of them are a bit wishy-washy. You know, it's one of them suggests, for example, that unlike our primate ancestors, human society, human cooperative societies, band societies, are not territorial. And when I say they're not territorial, they don't have rigid territories. That's not to say that they don't, some of them don't exhibit any kind of territoriality whatsoever. Some of them mark out bands, mark out the bounds, that the bounds in which they hunt. But even in those cases, other bands can enter their territory, and there's not really much they can do about it. Most of them have some kind of system where visiting bands are required to ask their permission, but the idea of refusing permission is just unthinkable. It seems to be that when they're asking permission, what the purpose of that is to make sure that the home team and the incomers are not going to sort of forage and hunt in the same area, and so just sort of mess each other up. So that seems to be the only kind of reason for that. So we are not territorial. Hunter-gatherer human beings are not territorial in the way that our primate relatives are fiercely territorial. And it's said that because of territoriality, our primates have to defend their territory much more vigorously than human beings do. Therefore, they have to use fighting, violence, and therefore hierarchical societies tend to promote that. They tend to generate alpha males who tend to reproduce and produce more violent alpha males, and so on and so forth, and so that they actually can defend their territories more effectively. We don't have to do that as human beings, and so we have developed this lack of this sense of egalitarianism. I don't really buy that much, as I'm no expert. Don't hang on to any words that I may say, but this is just my opinion. I don't really buy that very much. I think that's the kind of fairly weak argument, because you have to kind of argue, you have to then to say, well, why did we become less territorial in this way? So you're really not really answering the question. I think a much better answer is one that I've kind of proposed before. That's not my proposal, that I've actually put to the party before. And that is because we started producing big brain babies. Big brains are extremely costly in energy terms. And big brain babies, our big brain babies, remain babies for 20 years, I would say 25 years, looking back on it from sort of from my age. But they need, our children are very dependent for a very long time, and they have very costly energy consuming brains. Brains take up most of our energy. And so females are simply not capable of provisioning for their big brain babies, and so therefore require the cooperation of males. And so over time, human females have developed strategies for encouraging males to provision them, because among our primates kind of relatives, everyone just provisions themselves. Even the alpha males among gorillas and chimpanzees, no matter how dominant they may be, each they provision for themselves. The only exception to that is when, for example, a chimpanzee finds a huge cache of fruit, that they live mainly on fruit, although they do eat meat as well. If they find a big cache of fruit which they can't consume, they will tolerate another male coming and stealing it. Anthropologists and ethologists call this tolerated theft. And they kind of rather deviously tried to apply it to human beings to try and pretend that we're not egalitarian. But I'll kind of come to that in a bit. So perhaps it's likely that because we started producing big-brained babies who were dependent for many years, we were forced to become egalitarian. And certainly, if we move over to social psychology, there's been lots of research done on cooperation and conflict, competition, cooperation and competition between humans. The universal kind of agreement now, the consensus among social psychologists, is that both competition and cooperation are inherent in human genetic disposition, and that they are both learned behaviors. We have to learn cooperation just as much as we actually have to learn competition. So, for example, if you look at particularly Asian hunting, immediate return band hunter-gatherers, you'll find that they have such a horror of violence and competition that they will not defend themselves at all. When Europeans turned up in Indonesia, the Dutch initially, they found these people who looked useful for slaves. And so slavers went in and tried to capture them. And instead of fighting, they simply ran. They ran into the forest because they could, because there were no other tribal or territorial peoples within the forest who would prevent them doing that. They simply ran away. And when anthropologists talked to them about this and said, well, you know, why don't you fight back? They just respond with horror at the idea at having to kill somebody. But they say that would mean killing somebody. And they just couldn't countenance that. So cooperation, lack of violence, is a capacity for human beings, and that's clearly demonstrated in hunter-gatherer, immediate return band hunter-gatherer groups. So whatever the cause was, we did transition from a hierarchical to sorry, I'm losing words. Just a minute, let me have a drink. We did transition from a competitive to a cooperative animal. Another way we know that, going back into history and prehistory, there's a rather clever genetic test that has been done, and it's a piece of genetic research. Fortunately, human beings have certain genes which are only passed down through the male line, and certain genes that are only passed down the female line. So we can actually look at the genetic history down the female and male lines. The Y chromosome in the male is only passed down through the male line. I mean, there is an issue now with trans people, because you can actually have a functioning womb and produce babies, and yet have exact XY male chromosomes. It's not actually a simple relationship between that one gene and whether you are biologically a female or a male. But I think it's something like 0.1%. So we can actually have quite a good view of this in terms of the genetic inheritance down the Y chromosome from male to male to male to male to male. We also have mitochondria, which are the little kind of power packs inside the human cells. And these were once separate living, we think, we're pretty sure, these were once separately living organisms, bacteria, that were once swallowed by our ancestors and instead of being consumed, managed to survive and decided to stay. And they provide our cells with energy. But because they were once separate living creatures, they have their own DNA, which is quite separate from all the rest of our human DNA, which sits in the nucleus. The chromosomal DNA in mitochondria is quite separate from our own. And that is only passed on through the female line. So we can actually look at human, we can look at hunter-gatherers, band hunter-gatherers, and we can look at their genetic history, because we know, for example, that we've tested this out, that among matrilocal societies where men migrate to where women live, there is a greater complexity and input of male genes. So we can test that on the male line down the Y chromosome. And when men go to, and when women go to live with men in a male's community, there is a greater input of female genetic diversity into the genome. So we, and we've tested this out on societies that we know have been matrilocal for many thousands of years, and we found that this is actually the case. So that's our control. And when we look at hunter-gatherers, band hunter-gatherers, we can see that, for example, the San peoples of South Africa have been matrilocal. Men have actually gone to live with women so that women can get the support of their other women in their family. Men have gone to live with their women for at least 80,000 years. This is actually marked very clearly in their genetic makeup with the Mbuti and with the Banyako in sub-Saharan Africa. We've done research on those, and we know that they have at least been matrilocal for 40,000 years. So we can't go right back to the beginning of our species, which has now been pushed back to about 330, 340,000 years. But we can go back a fair way, and we can say that these people were matrilocal. And what we know about matrilocal societies is that the only matrilocal societies that exist are band hunter-gatherers. All other societies that we know of, delayed return village hunter-gatherers, tend to be patriarchal. So we know that we have this long history of being egalitarian in terms of our social relationships. Now, but we've done a U-turn. We started off as hierarchical. We went through this long phase of 2,500, 3,000 years of being egalitarian, and we've now turned competitive and hierarchical again. And this all begins, it's hard to put an exact figure on it, but sometime around 6,000 years ago, in the middle of the Neolithic period, sometimes called the Mesolithic. And historically, this has been put down to the practice of farming. Remember that social psychologists have declared that, you know, we both have the capacity to be competitive and cooperative, and we need to learn. So, you know, we can go either way. So it's obviously there within our sort of makeup. So 6,000 years ago-ish, we started to develop state-sized societies in Mesopotamia, in China, on the major rivers, on in the Indus Valley, in sub-Saharan Africa, in North America, in South America. And so we have this lineage that we can trace. And every single one of them became eventually strongly hierarchical societies. We returned to hierarchical relationships. And again, the question of why we did that is an open question. It seemed to be a very simple question some years ago, some about a decade or a couple of decades ago, that it seemed to be quite obvious that once we started farming, were investing, we became delayed return societies. And delayed return society means that you have to invest labor into the land, effectively. And you have to do that for months on end before you get a return on it. You get a delayed return from the land. And once we began investing our labor in the land, we obviously wanted to protect the crops that we had actually grown in the land. And so this was seen as the beginnings of hierarchical society, because not everyone at that time was becoming a hunter-gatherer, becoming a sort of a farming agricultural society. And there have always been clashes between hunter-gatherers and farmers, because farmers obviously have this concept of the investment of labor, and they want to protect that investment. But hunter-gatherers just see it as a product of nature, and they do not accept that anyone has a particular claim on produce, on the produce of the land. And so we get this competition. And so for farming societies, they had to protect their crops, not just from other farming societies. For example, if there is a famine, if crops fail, for example, but they have to protect them from hunter-gatherers as well. So you start to because crops actually produce more food than hunter-gathering, you can actually get a division of labor. And so you begin to get a military class that can actually protect, whose role is to protect the land. And they actually start eventually to seize power, and you begin to get a hierarchical society. It begins in Mesopotamia with the early temple societies, where the priests have exclusive power and develop sort of ritual power through sort of basically scaring people into subservience, because we're threatening the action of the gods. And then eventually into developing military kingships, who then take over, and you begin to get this sort of standard pattern of hierarchical societies. Now, there is evidence. It's weak, and it's not kind of accepted by everyone, by anthropologists generally. There is evidence that human beings continued to be egalitarian right into the Mesolithic, when state societies began to form. Now, people like Greybull and Wengrow really hold on to this and try and make a big issue of this, because being anarchists, they want to be able to say that, you know, it's not just kind of nomadic peoples, you know, even in cities we can have egalitarianism. But we have to look at the facts. The evidence for egalitarianism, continuing egalitarianism in cities, there is some evidence for it, but it doesn't persist for very long, and it's actually quite weak. But then that raises the question, then why did we become farmers in the first place? Well, again, there are numerous sort of proposals for this, but it does seem that the most reliable one at the moment is climate change. early farming was a pretty... it was assumed by the early anthropologists that farmers, because they could produce so much more, had so much of a better life. Life became easier for them. And we know that the opposite. We know now that the opposite is absolutely the case. That in fact, we must have been forced into farming, because hunter-gatherer societies are so much more. They're healthier, you know, because when you're forced into close proximity in farming groups, you pass diseases on. The work is backbreaking. It's hard, and it's continuous. Whereas hunter-gatherers put far fewer hours into the day in order to obtain what they need, and they simply choose to need little. And once you actually start to develop a surplus, then your expectations kind of grow, and you start to demand more, and therefore you have to put more labor in, and it becomes a kind of self-reinforcing cycle. So we think it was climate change. We think that what happened was in the Lower Dryas, which was a mini ice age, The climate, hunter-gatherers had previously moved north as the climate improved, and then we got this mini ice age, and they were forced south again. And so there was a huge population bulge in the south of the European continent, and in South Asia, presumably, as well, although that's less researched. And that meant that hunter-gathering could no longer supply the needs of everyone, because hunter-gatherers, for a given population, they need a huge range in which to hunt and to gather. So they were probably forced into farming at an early age, and at an early state of the lower Dryas, of the younger Dryas. And so they started by gathering. It's called sort of gathering on the hilly margins. This is the sort of rather poetic phrase that is sometimes used. Basically, what it means that they weren't actually farming. What they were doing is that they were harvesting wild grasses on the valley margins of the major rivers. So it wasn't originally a riverine. These state societies were not, or farming societies were not, riverine to start with. They weren't based on in the river basins. They were based on the hilly margins where the wild grasses grow. And gradually they began to realize that, you know, if you sowed seeds, that you could actually therefore make sure that there was a harvest for the next year. And this became more and more organized. But of course, as this became more and more organized, it became more stratified, society became more stratified, and they started diversifying. And so they moved down into the valleys and started where there was better irrigation. And they started the whole work of civilization, building canals to kind of take... somebody has just said from Manto, the agricultural revolution's consequence has been a disaster for the human race. Yeah, I mean, in many ways, that's actually the case. I mean, you can argue it. There are people who say, but, you know, we now have art, we now have science, we have everything. It depends on your attitude. But, you know, I kind of secretly, I mean, I would probably die within a few weeks, but I quite fancy being a hunter-gatherer. It seems to me like quite a attractive lifestyle. But anyway, they moved into the valleys, and we're beginning to get sort of development of agriculture. But we now understand something that we didn't understand 50 years ago, that agriculture didn't just happen quickly. It took, we think now, at least 2,000 years to develop agriculture. And having developed agriculture, it then took another 2,000 years for us to develop state societies, stratified societies, class societies. And being a creature who had a hierarchical, had a long hierarchical history in our early stages, and who had a capacity for hierarchy as well as a capacity for cooperation, it was possible for us to go back. Now, the question then arises, and it's a big question. The question then arises, can we return to a non-hierarchical condition with a society, with a major population, and with large-scale, vast-scale productive capacity, with cooperation on a vast scale in terms of production? And I think it's an open question. I think what we can say by studying immediate return band hunter-gatherers, is we can learn from them exactly what it is that needs to be done in order to maintain egalitarian relationships, cooperative egalitarian relationships, because they do have to work at it. I think sort of a lot of kind of socialists that I've spoken to, or, you know, socialists, you know, in air quotes, seem to assume that, you know, if we have egalitarian, if we have egalitarian, if we get rid of property, we'll automatically maintain egalitarian relationships. It's, the evidence seems that that's not the case, that egalitarian societies work very, very hard to maintain their egalitarian relationships. And they were very successful at it, as we have seen over tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of years. So it can be done within the context of a banned society. And what we can learn from banned societies is that one of the major ways that they do this, and I think this is really important, is that they maintain mobility. Mobility is central to the way in which they maintain egalitarianism. And by mobility, I mean individual mobility. They can just, somebody doesn't like what's happening around them, they can just get up and go. They can just walk away. If there is somebody in a band, you know, bands can kind of typically between 15 and 50 people. Typically in a band, if somebody is just, you know, causing a nuisance, and people will, you know, people cheat, and you get sort of kind of sociopaths, even within band societies, who sort of abusive and violent towards other people. What happens is that people get up and walk away. And if people start claiming status and claiming that they're entitled to more than other people, and that happens as well, especially among young hunters, young men, the rest of the people can get up and they can go and join another band. They can just simply walk away. That kind of mobility is profoundly important. And if you think about it, you know, even in a socialist society, hugely productive society, which can produce a surplus, a regular surplus, you know, if you have an individual is in an egalitarian society, cannot stand between anyone else and their ability to meet their needs, because they can just go to the common store, whatever you like, to it and take it. So individuals have no power, but potentially it is possible that if you could get a group of people getting together and they would sort of say, okay, we're going to control this now. We don't like the way this is going. We're going to control this. You get 50, 60 people, they can control the local stores, yeah, and try and prevent people from accessing to them. That is the way that that is the way, or one way at least, that hierarchical society can emerge, because we know that it can emerge out of egalitarian society. But so long as people are mobile, they can just get up and they can walk away from this. They can say, okay, you know, you're standing there, you've got some kind of weapons, you're preventing us, you're demanding that we give you extra. Okay, you've got control of the store. You can take what extra you like, although kind of why would they need to? There's a bit of a problem. But, you know, just as a potential that, you know, if something like that could arise, and, you know, we can't absolutely rule it out, then people can walk away. Walking away, mobility is so important. But that's the one thing, mobility is the one thing that a socialist society would have, you know, because, you know, if you need a home, okay, we could have a surplus of homes, because people are likely to want to be mobile to some extent at any rate. And, you know, we can accommodate them. There's no buying and selling. There's no property relationships that would actually make transferring your home from one place to another that difficult. So mobility is really important. The other really important way in which hunter-gatherers maintain their egalitarian relationships is by exercising social disapproval. And this sounds like incredibly weak way of going about things, but in an egalitarian, in an established egalitarian society, as we understand from hunter-gatherers, it's actually extremely powerful. It's a very powerful way of maintaining social harmony, because, I mean, we have, I'm sure I've said this before, but I think it's worth saying again. Psychologists have identified, and neurologists have identified, that when most people experience social disapproval, their brain lights up like crazy. And what lights up are the pain pathways, exactly the same pathways in the brain that light up when you experience physical pain. We've obviously evolved as a cooperative species, and we've evolved as people who are very sensitive to social approval and disapproval. And and societies, egalitarian societies, use this constantly and to great effect to ensure that people do not claim status or actually achieve status in any notable way. I mean, there's quite a lot more I could say about this, but so all I will say is immediate return hunter-gatherers, we shouldn't run away with the idea that because they exist, we can be confident that socialism can work. But it gives us a degree of confidence that at least it's not, there is nothing in our biological makeup that would prevent it working. And there is nothing in our social makeup that we couldn't at least have a go at making it working. We have techniques that we know work for immediate return people. So apart from all that, I will shut up now and pass it over to everyone else.